Looks like trouble.
Looks like Christmas.
Hello and welcome to episode 28 of Popcorn and Prosecco, a show that is all about movies, movies and more movies, and we've got some interesting ones to discuss this week. I'm Perry Nemroff, and here are my co-hosts, Christy Puchko and Angie Han.
Hey guys.
Hello.
Alright, so the ones that we're going to hit this week are Sin City 2, Sin City, A Dame to Kill For, Love is Strange, and If I Stay, and we're starting with Sin City, and Angie's got that one.
Alright, so if you have seen the first Sin City, then I probably don't even really need to explain this to you, because, alright, so, you know, it's set in Sin City, which is this, like, very, the most noirish city that has ever existed, or not existed, because it's not a real city. And there are four different storylines, and I don't even want to go into the specifics, but one of them stars Mickey Rourke, one of them stars Joseph Gordon-Levitt, one of them stars, who am I forgetting?
Jessica,
one of them stars Jessica Alba, and I think there's one more.
Josh Brolin. You forgot the one it's named for.
Right! And then one of them stars Josh Brolin. That's
Wait, but isn't Josh Brolin and Eva Green's the same story?
Yeah. No, I didn't say Eva Green, I said Jessica.
Yeah.
Alba. Sorry. So anyway, as you guys can tell by this, it's confusing. There are four different storylines that are sort of like, they just sort of like weave in and out of each other. And I don't want to get too much into the specifics of each one, because then that'll take up so much of this, our discussion time, just because there's so many of them.
Hookers, murder,
basically, sex. What you need to know is that they're all, you know, it's in fucking city. They're all the same, okay? Like, there's like, you know, like, tough men and, like, and, like, you know, guns and punches and, like...
Naked women.
And, like, beautiful women who are all invariably whores or sluts.
And people flying out windows. How many people get punched out of windows in this movie?
Basically, there's just... That's all you really need to know. And I didn't... And if you've seen the first movie, I probably didn't even need to tell you that much, because it's more of the same. But I don't know. Like, I just... I went in, to be perfectly honest, I went in not expecting to like this movie that much, because I just can't with, like, Frank Miller's worldview. I mean, I guess it makes him happy, but it's just not how, I don't know, whatever. Like, I have very little patience for it, so I was expecting not to like it. I did enjoy it a little bit more than I thought that I would, I guess because my expectations were so low, but overall, like, this is not a good movie. First of all, like I said, the fact that there are four different storylines, and they feel so similar, like, you know, I guess the specifics are different, but, like, the tones are, like, the tone of each storyline is exactly the same, like, the themes are exactly the same, like, that made it so boring for me, and one of the major new characters is Joseph Gordon-Levitt, who, like, doesn't seem to fit into this world at all, and the other thing that kind of, that the maybe the most upsetting thing is that, like, if Sin City has anything going for it, it's the style, but to me, this movie was so, like, it looks so cheap and ugly. And I don't mean cheap in, like, the way that, like, every one of those movies is cheap in, like, a cool noirish way. I mean cheap, like, it looked like, you know, like, a senior project instead of, like, a major movie made by a major studio.
It looked like most of the cast was, like, playing dress-up. Like, they found this weird box of costumes, and let's just stick it all on and see what
happens. What a show!
I totally agree. That was my problem with it, was, one, there's not as much graphic work in it, which is really shocking.
You mean compared to the last film?
Yeah, compared to the last one, there's not that much. And then, two, like, it just felt so low budget. Because, like, in the first movie, when they introduced us to the girls of Old Town, those women each had, like, a distinctive look, and they had such sharp costumes, and everything looked really thought out. And this time, when the girls of Old Town show up, or Old Town showed up, I made a joke that it seemed like SWV or All Saints, because it just seemed like a low-grade pop group that can't, like, their costumes are, like, similar, but they're not fancy.
I wonder if Rosario Dawson willingly put that mask over her head.
Well, that's in the comic. It's stupid looking in the comic, too.
Oh, my God, it's awful. Like, she came out, and
I didn't mind the mask.
I felt so sad for her.
Well, I didn't mind the mask.
And then some of the characters are just wearing T-shirts, which is just distracting and weird, because, like, if you're going to do these sharp black and white contrasts, you want something with texture, and, like, there's such a lack of texture in the costumes, and then weirdly, because they shot in HD, everyone's faces have way too much texture, where even, like, the incredibly beautiful Eva Green and that little girl who looks like she's 16 who plays a prostitute, like, they kind of look like hell, because the bags under their eyes are just so big in HD. It's just really disorienting.
Yeah,
it's a profoundly ugly movie.
And, like, Mickey Rourke's, like, facial prosthetics are very distracting. Like, I don't remember being as distracted by it in the last movie, but I guess maybe for the reasons that you were saying. Like, the whole movie, I just kept being like, it's uncanny because it could tell it's not real, but it looks almost real, and I kept just thinking that.
And then also, I wasn't as bothered by the look of everything. Like, I'll admit, you guys are definitely right. Some things look cheap, and I kept looking at Mickey Rourke being like, something's not quite right with you. I just couldn't handle the fact that the way the stories were woven in, because it's like...
I mean, woven is being kind. They're just kind of smacked in sequences. It doesn't feel... There's no flow.
But it's like they wanted to be a linear narrative, kind of, but then it wanted to be an anthology, and everything's just mixed up, and, like, they're not all mixed up. Like, when we get Josh Brolin's story, we get it in one big chunk. And, like, I've said this a couple times to you guys, at one point, you start with Joseph Gordon-Levitt's character, and then it goes to Josh Brolin, and because of the way that cut happens, I've never read the comic, so I don't know anything. I thought that Joseph Gordon-Levitt was a younger version of Josh Brolin, and it
Which
took me, like, a solid 10 minutes to figure out that he wasn't.
Especially because Josh Brolin... Especially because Josh Brolin in this movie is Clive Owen, so you're just like, well, I don't know, maybe the guy just changes actors all the time.
Which in the comic makes sense, because if you remember it from the first movie, and if you don't, I totally understand, but I actually watched the first movie right before I saw the second one, so, like, very refreshed. In the first movie, which the part that Clive Owen's in that takes place after the part that Josh Brolin is in this movie, they say, like, I didn't even recognize you with your new face. So that makes sense to a degree, except for that in this movie they also give Josh Brolin a new face partway through the plot, which can
be... That was so stupid. Like,
which is
that? The second he got off the train, I'm like, duh, really? Is nobody else here?
It's not like... Okay, so he changes his face, I guess, as a disguise, and despite the fact that he still just looks like a very slightly altered version of Josh Brolin, nobody recognizes him. It's like when Superman puts on glasses, like, suddenly no one can, like, tell who he is. Christy, if you took off your glasses right now, comic books tell me, I would be like, who is this new woman who is on our podcast?
Ready for some magic, everyone?
Perry, who the fuck is that? I don't want to be awkward, but I don't recognize this woman.
Guys, I'm back!
Oh, God! Oh,
shit!
Anyway, so Josh Brolin's facial transformation is about that.
Can we please talk about Jessica Alba, because she's so bad in this movie, and she ends the movie. That's the thing that's so upsetting. So Nancy from the first movie, who's like the stripper, who's like, which also in the comics, like, Nancy's like naked all the time, like all the time, all the time, all the time.
Jessica Alba wears like the most clothes I've ever seen.
It reminds me of people
in Brooklyn walking down the street wearing less clothes than she wears on stage. As a fucking stripper.
Totally true. And it actually reminded me a lot of that Lindsay Lohan movie, I Know Who Killed Me, where she wears so much clothes as a stripper, and then the dances that she does as a stripper that are supposed to be sexy are so awkward that you're just like, I feel bad for you. This
well, it's also because Jessica Alba can't play drunk for her life.
Oh, no, she's so funny. Ooh. David Ehrlich from Fighting in the War Room and I were talking, and he was like, has she never been drunk? Does she not know what that looks like? Like, it's hilarious.
I've actually heard that that playing drunk is pretty difficult, but, I mean, you would think someone on set would have pulled her aside and been like, yeah, you're doing it incorrectly.
It was like a cartoon version of playing drunk. It's like, let's swig the bottle.
Yeah,
like, that's all she did. And then she just kept slamming it down and picking it back up.
And then there's that scene that's like a bad version of Black Swan where she smashes her face into a mirror. It just doesn't make any sense. So basically her story in this one is it's after that yellow bastard, Hartigan is dead because he killed himself in the first movie, and she's so alone that she's thinking of killing Rourke, but instead she gets drunk a lot and lies to people and smashes up her face and whatever. Anyway, it doesn't make any sense. It doesn't matter. The point is that Jessica Alba is a bad actress. It's unfortunate, and I hate to say it, but it's just true. She's lovely, but she can't dance in this movie. I guess she's sexy because we took a poll, like a general poll of the straight men in the audience afterwards, and we're like, was that hot to you? And they're like, well, I mean, yeah.
She's
I was like, all right, fine.
Maybe they were just thinking of Eva Green beforehand. It's like you can't have Jessica Alba follow up Eva Green and expect
Eva Green is so naked.
She's not a stripper, but she is naked constantly in this movie.
She's such a good actress that she can get away with anything. It's just so much freaking fun to watch that woman. It's probably a little too much Eva Green in this movie for me, but she is just so funny, and, you know, that's probably some of the best editing, too. Because some of her lines would happen, or someone else's line, and, like, the cut would just happen at the right time, where something that might have been a really shitty joke turns out to be a great joke.
Well, we should explain, like, Eva Green plays the
end of this movie.
Eva Green plays the femme fatale in this movie. Like
she's the dame to kill for.
Yeah, she's the dame to kill for. You know, I don't think it's a spoiler to say that she's
No, they make it clear in the trailer.
The femme fatale. Yeah, it's also called a dame to kill for. And she just kind of swans into like Josh Brolin's life and just like turns it upside down, and she's just like, and the whole like plot hinges on like you believing that this woman is so just like intoxicatingly irresistible that all sense just flies out of everyone's head the second you see her. And you know what? She works it so much. I totally was just like, it's yeah. So I mean, he's acting dumb, but in the context of this movie, it makes total fucking sense.
In my cinema, over the top.
It's amazing.
I just feel bad that this movie exists permanently. Like, it really disturbs me to think about what people will do with this movie when they can own it. Like, I'm scared for her.
You're scared of how many people are going to masturbate to her? Please, they've already been masturbating to her since, but I don't like, even know, like, for years.
302, she's like, pretty dreadful. Like, this is kind of her
thing. She's, like, legit naked. I'm not exaggerating. Yeah. She is naked 75% of this movie. Like, how...
And when she's not naked, she's in lingerie. Although, to be fair, it's not clear that Sin City women's clothing stores sell anything but lingerie.
So, yeah, I don't think that like, Sin City believes in clothes.
Well, she has a coat, but a lot of the time she just wears nothing under it. So I guess, like, that kind of counts.
Even when she's, like, fully clothed, it's like, you know, she's wearing a blue coat that she, like, takes off, and obviously she's naked under it.
And completely shaved. There was no hair below her brow line on that body. It's hilarious. I mean, the thing is, it's like, I actually really loved Eva Green. She's the only thing, I wrote Mice in Review, she's the only thing I liked in this movie because, like you said, she's so over the top. I think she's one of the actors
that, like, really gets what this movie is trying to do. I think she read the script.
It reminded me of when Gina Gershon talked about when she got the script for Showgirls and thought it was legit going to be a good movie. Then she showed up on set and was like, oh, I see what this is. And then she said that she walked onto that set and said, I'm going to create a portrayal that drag queens are going to emulate for decades. And I feel like that's what Eva Green did with this movie, where she was like, I am just going to live for everything. I am going to be Bette Davis if she was naked. I'm going to be Barbara Stanwyck if she was showing off her everything. Like, she just plays the femme fatale to a point that is insane. And I have to admit, that was really fun and funny to watch. It was like my favorite scene in the movie is she's trying to convince this cop played by Chris Maloney, who is painfully underused, that she's scared, and she's, like, naked on the phone, and her tits are, like, well above water, because that's comfortable, and she's like, I'm just so scared. I really don't want to be alone tonight. It's like, she doesn't give a fuck, and it's so funny. Like, that's by far my favorite. Like, that got laughs in the theater, because it's like, that's, like, the perfect moment, but there's this doesn't work.
I mean, in conclusion, I don't think this is a good movie overall, but of the people I have spoken to who are looking forward to this movie, most of them are, like, you know, straight men who are huge Eva Green fans, and if you're a straight man or a gay woman who's a huge Eva Green fan, watch this movie. She's naked in it. She, like, just, like, you know, lounges around, like, being, like, sultry and sexy. I don't know. I feel like it's not a good movie, but if that's what you're into, then this is kind of perfect for that.
I don't know if I could recommend this movie, but the only reason I would recommend this movie, like, I feel like Sin City... I don't want to spoil our show later on, but Sin City for me majorly benefited from how much If I Stay just freaking sucked. So if you asked me between the two, if you really wanted to see a movie, I'd say, hey, go see Sin City. If Sin City was the only thing that came out this weekend, I'd be like, eh, you know, maybe VOD if you're into that kind of stuff.
I'm with you.
I'm going to say, I would tell no one to see this in theaters. It's not worth the high price ticket. I actually did think the 3D is good, so if you're dead set on seeing this, I think the 3D is a little worthwhile. But I would say that if you're curious about this, just wait till DVD, because then the stupid sequences, you can just fast forward through. And once you get to Nancy and her plot, just stop.
Just stop.
I think you're right. Like, I think people should see it, but I don't think they should shell out money for the full price theatrical ticket. And also, this way, people can masturbate while watching the Eva Green scenes, like Perry was saying.
Yeah, and it won't be weird for the rest of the people in the theater.
Yeah, less
be
weird.
I feel like that'd be a really awkward pull quote right there. That would probably get people to see this movie, too.
Yeah.
All right. There's no appropriate transition for this, so Christy, just go train.
I got
nothing.
So a movie that has nothing at all to do with Sin City in any inclination.
It's the polar opposite of Sin City in pretty much every way I can imagine, except for the fact that it's also technically a movie. Like, but they're both films.
So this is from Ira Sachs. It's called Love is Strange. It is an independent movie that hit the festival circuit earlier this year and is now coming out in limited release. It stars John Lithgow and Alfred Molina as two men who have been together for decades. When they get married, Alfred Molina, who works at a Catholic school, is fired from his job because Catholicism. And so when that happens, they realize they can no longer afford their apartment in Manhattan, and they are forced to separate so that they can stay with friends. And it's about that time in their life. And it's a really beautiful movie that is political in a context that it is about gay marriage to a point. But what's really incredible is just the performances of these two men and how gentle and tender this movie is. Because Ira Sachs's last movie felt really kind of almost antagonistic, and it felt like it was making its point in its point in a very kind of direct manner. And this is just a very touching movie about love and about different forms, because like for the Alfred Molina character, he moves in with neighbors who are very supportive, but they're also like young men, and so like they're partying legit every night, and he's an old man on their couch, so he has to wait until they all go to bed, and it's kind of a problem for him. And then on John Lithgow's end, he goes to stay with his nephew, who's like away a lot, so then he's staying with his stay-at-home wife, who like works from home.
And Marissa Tomei.
Marissa Tomei, and she's
very
really
good in this.
Yeah, it's a really beautiful ensemble piece. I saw it at the Tribeca Film Festival earlier this year, and I started my review saying that I was in no way prepared for how much this movie was going to make me cry. It's not that it's a sad movie exactly, it's just that it's a really heartbreaking and beautiful movie that like made me, it really grabbed onto me and made me experience this. And it's really fantastic that, you know, a lot of times, two actors can't for the life of them create a chemistry that makes you believe them as a couple, but Alfred Molina and John Lithgow in this, like, from the first frames, you just believe it, and you become so invested in their story. I think Love is Strange is outstanding.
Yeah, I would be a little more positive about it, if not for the heartbreaking parts, because, like, I actually, when it first started, and probably, like, 75% of the way through it, like, it's a drama, but, like, I was kind of, like, having fun with their situation a little. Like, there's a lot of sad parts, but it was a lot. I was looking at it as a much lighter movie, and then, I mean, you know what happens. And whereas if that didn't happen, I would have gone back and watched this again and had a lot of fun with it. But now I'll once is enough. I don't want to see that again.
It's funny to me that you're like, oh, you know, because, like, well, the stuff that happens at the end, because to me, like, there's, like, a undercurrent of sadness, like, throughout the whole film. Like, you know, it starts with them getting married, and then immediately goes to them being separated, which, like, I thought, and, like, you know, it's funny, and, like, the movie isn't, like, it's not, like, a, you know, like, a very dramatic, like, lots of twists and turns kind of drama, but, you know, it's always, like, really sad, like, you know, they've spent the last, like, several decades, like, sleeping side by side, and now they can't, and, like, that's already kind of heartbreaking without any dramatic twist.
But I liked all that stuff. Like, that stuff I found really interesting because, you know, it's funny that John Lithgow is sleeping on a bunk bed, but at the same time, they never let you forget that these are two people who have lived together for 39 years of their life, and all of a sudden they're ripped apart. So I like the balance there, but that's kind of what my focus was on, so when the other thing happened, it's like, wait, that's not what I was here for. Where did that come from?
Well, yeah. I do feel like the ending is earned. I thought about that a lot after I saw it, but yeah, I was unprepared. I saw it early in the morning, and I was actually with my friend Daniel Wolber, who is also a movie writer, and we walk out, and I'm like literally like wiping tears away from my face, like walking out at like 10 in the morning, because it was a really early screening. He's like, are you okay? I was like, I'm wearing mascara was a mistake today, and I regret everything. But I'm really glad I saw this movie. And we've talked about some depressing movies, and I feel like we need to kind of create a scale. Like, this is not, like,
it's not depressing.
Sad.
No.
It's sad, but it's, like, this is not, like, you're going to be devastated and not be able to, like, sleep properly for a little while.
I think it's, I would say bittersweet more than, like, sad or depressing. And I think it's so tender and warm, and I think, like you said, like, the amazing chemistry between Molina and Lithgow is just, like, from the first frame, you just completely buy that these are two people who have spent most of their lives together.
And they're just a very likable couple. It's like, it's so easy to get behind them and want them to win and, like, get what they need. So it's really easy to get
through. It's not, but it doesn't, like, sugarcoat their relationship either. Like, it kind of makes it clear, especially as the film goes on, like, that this is a relationship that has, like, hit some really, like, bad parts at points. You know, just the way that would happen if you've been with the same person for that long.
Now, there's one question I want to ask you two, because this is becoming a bit of a kerfuffle on the internet this week. Love is Strange is rated R.
Ugh, really?
Why?
Yeah,
why?
So that's my question. So I admittedly saw this months ago, so I don't totally remember. It's being rated R for quote-unquote language. Now, let's keep in mind that last week, Expendables 3 was rated PG-13, despite the fact that, like, literally hundreds are mowed down in the final sequences.
Yeah, also, like, every other action summer blockbuster.
I can't think of a single bad word.
Apparently,
nobody
they
ever used, like, a curse word in, like, a nasty way.
Like, well, by MPAA rules, I think the rule of thumb is, like, if someone says, if the word fuck is uttered more than once, then it's, like, automatically an R. Almost.
But I don't even remember the word fuck being uttered at all.
I don't either. It's admittedly been a while, but Perry, you saw it recently, and
I saw it, like, 2-3 weeks ago, and I don't remember anything like that.
The suspicion is that it's because it is a relationship about two gay men, and the MPAA has shown a lot tendency to be way harsher on films that are about gay couples because you need to protect children.
Well, that's completely unjustified, too, because it's not like they're, like, rubbing it in your face in, like, an inappropriate way.
It's not like they're having sex on screen or anything. It's absurd.
That's crazy because it's, like, the heart of the relationship in this movie is just, like, a simple, like, human connection that anybody in the world can relate to.
I mean, it's just yet another example of, like, how the MPAA, like, I kind of get in theory what they're trying to do, but, like, then you hear about, like, how is this rated R? Like, you're just...
Yeah, like, this is rated R, and also Sin City is rated R, where we literally saw how many people get decapitated. You see pieces of people get torn off and ripped off and thrown in places. A woman is so naked that it's hilarious to me that the MPAA is like, this is just an R, not NC-17.
That's what I was thinking the entire way through that movie, is how is that getting an R?
So much naked.
And yet, I guess because, I don't know, maybe... Alfred Molina says the word fuck more than once or something? Who the fuck knows? We don't even know. Our podcast would be rated R because I'm pretty sure he said the word fuck at least a couple times already. So, sorry.
So just some food for thought, guys. It's rated R on quote-unquote language. Which, if you're listening to our podcast, we've already said fuck more than that movie.
The other thing that is, like, you know, it's not an overtly political film, but... One of the things I thought was interesting was, like, you know, I kind of went in being like, oh, okay, it's a movie about a gay couple, but it's actually almost even more about the fact that they're old and the fact that there's no, like, really... It's
support system.
To me, it felt even more political in that, like, in, like, what it was saying about the way that our society treats, like, people who are old. Like, basically, you know, once Alfred Molina's built this, like, beautiful life for himself with John Lithgow, the two of them together, but then once one of them retires, they're essentially homeless, like... You know, the only reason they're not literally out on the streets is because they're lucky enough to have good friends that have extra space.
Yeah, and they do go into the details of what they try to do to find a home, and it's just so convoluted and complicated. And, I mean, it's also another thing that I feel like, you know, homelessness is something we all tend to think happens to other people, and the movie makes the point that, like, you know, they were, like, one of them was a very successful painter, the other one had been working at that school for decades, and, you know, their decision to get married threw them on the street, effectively.
It's so easy for us to relate to them, too, because we live in these kinds of places. Like, I was really thinking about it, because at first, in the movie, when they decide that they have to split, I'm like, why do you have to split up? Like, you can cram together on a couch. But then, as the movie went on, and I kind of started to process it, and then I'm thinking, well, what if two people were sleeping on my couch? That's not going to work.
Yeah, no. I actually, like, my husband and I hosted a friend for what was supposed to be a couple of weeks, and it turned into 5, and guys, that gets old fast in New York, because our apartments aren't big. They're fine for two people, but it's like wedging another person in there, like... It got ugly, guys.
It's also just, like, disrupting your daily life, too. And that's something, no matter where you live, you can relate to that kind of thing. Like, even if it's family, even if it's someone you've lived with before, all of a sudden that person is back in, like, this existence.
And they hit
that you made
all those notes. Because, like, while Alfred Molina, like, the people hosting him don't mind that he's there. They think it's great. They love him. But they're also always having parties, so he's just included. And then in the John Lithgow and, like, Marissa Tomei's character is getting increasingly agitated because... Her home is where she works during the day, and it's really hard to have someone in your office all day.
Which I think we can all relate to.
I was freaking out during that scene because it's like, I totally know what you mean. I've been that person sitting there and someone talking in my ear while I'm trying to write.
Yeah, like, because, I mean, that happens to me sometimes when my husband doesn't have to go to work at the same time. He'll hang out for a bit, and he'll be like, hey, did I, and, like, I know it just looks like I'm in front of the computer, but this is work now. And I totally related to that scene where they're having this conversation about how he's like, I don't know that I can paint. It gets really distracting when someone else is around. He has, like, no concept of how distracting he's being to her. And, like, watching it, I was just like, oh, God, like, ugh. It's the movie understands New York, which is something we've complained about quite a few movies this summer that just don't get New York. This movie understands New York, and it understands, like, Ira Sachs tells a really elegant story, and it's one that feels human, not specifically political.
Yes.
I recommend.
So, recommend. Watch this instead of Sin City, unless you're, like, really into Eva Green, and then maybe still wait for the DVD.
Well, even though I didn't like the ending, I just want to say, I think this is well worth seeing. I didn't like the feeling it left me with, but I like the feeling that it gave me before all that happened.
I like the completeness of this. I like the whole thing, even though in the end I was crying. So I'm just giving you the heads up, if you're going to go, and I think you should, tissues and waterproof mascara.
You know, I think this is one of very few situations where if someone had said that to me before, I might have been more open to it. But I got so, like, tunnel vision into what I thought the movie was,
so,
and then
yeah.
It was outside of that.
It's like such a light movie because of the way it starts. I can see that.
Yeah. All right, well, now we're on to our next and our last one. I'm glad we had one good one this week. This movie is
spoilers
freaking killing me.
Spoilers on how we feel about it if I stay.
Seriously. Because, like, after The Giver, this is not what I needed. And I didn't read the book, If I Stay, so I have no connection to
it.
But, like, what are they doing to, like, the YA to film realm right now? We are having a shitty freaking month. Like,
you know,
hopefully we get to make more movies, because these two freaking suck.
I feel like that's just what happens when a trend goes up big. There are going to be some, like, good... There are going to be some, like, Hunger Games this, but then there's always going to be the duds.
Yeah, but, you know...
There's going to be If I Stay.
You know, after going through the experience of making a movie, I understand how, like, you could be so into it there, and you really, when you're on set, you can't see how a movie's going to come together after the fact. But seeing some of the things in this, like, how do you not realize that, like, 50% of your dialogue is, like, pure cliche crap?
All not right. even, I've seen more than 50.
Let's rewind and talk about what the movie's actually
right.
like.
Let's see the
so,
plot.
This movie stars Chloe Moretz as a cello prodigy named Mia Hall, and she's all, like, uptight, and she only has one friend, and she doesn't know how to deal with boys and all that nonsense. And then one day, the super hot boy at school, he sees her, and he's like, I want you. Nobody else notices you, but I notice you.
Yeah,
and
nobody else notices her, despite the fact that she looks like Chloe fucking Moretz.
Yeah,
in other words, she's gorgeous.
And has, like, a perfect wavy hair, which Lonnie is convinced was a wig.
I
think that's actually
real hair.
I think it's. I think it might be her real hair too. But, like, she even gets in a car accident, and her hair is perfect.
That's true.
I'm jumping ahead now. So they're having, like, this great little life, and she's all happy, and, like, she's applying to Juilliard, and everything is great. And then one day she gets in the car with her family, and they get into an accident, and she ends up in this state where she's, like, watching her body be wheeled away, and ultimately she needs to decide because things happen.
She's in a coma.
Do I want to keep living on, or do I just want to pass on to whatever is after life?
Well, yeah,
like, that's what it's about.
They never talk
about what's after, which is a really strange thing. She's choosing whether to stick around in a world where, we can decide later if we're going to get into the details, but there's a lot of things that you can understand she might want to walk away from, but they never talk about what's after. She mentions God exactly once in this movie.
Every once in a while, Christy, you see a glowing white light.
Yeah.
You know, I'm pretty sure that they mention what happens in the trailer, you know, before we start
tiptoeing
around all that stuff. I'm pretty sure they flat out say she'd be an orphan.
Okay.
Oh, no, they say that in all the trailers.
Yeah. So, like, her whole family is killed by this car crash, and her choice is to stay in the real world without them or move on.
Yeah. And that's the thing, it's weird, because, like, I thought for a movie that's so much about death and the potential of the afterlife, they don't talk about the afterlife so much, so the movie boils down to basically, because you know her whole family is dead, like, she has grandparents, but apparently they mean very little to her. The whole thing boils down to whether or not her boyfriend, who is estranged, is going to come back or not, and whether or not she's willing to stick around.
And who's an asshole? Seriously?
Oh, he is.
These two people are so fun. Yeah, I don't like him at all. So he's, like, super cute and, you know, slick and a good boyfriend to start. And then it's like he's like a fucking child. Out of nowhere, he throws this terrible temper tantrum where he's, like, totally unjustified. And he's being so freaking mean to her.
Oh,
and
no,
At that point, that was it.
It's apparently justified because he said this. He's had a sad life and people kept leaving him. He's just afraid that Chloe Moretz is going to leave him.
He seemed like Jordan Catalano, but then they were like, oh, but let's, like, tack on a bunch of other stuff. Like, he sees her and instantly tells her she's cute. He asks her on a date, and then he kind of just starts bullying his way into her life, which I know we were supposed to find romantic, but I thought was creepy.
I don't think that it's just him. Her parents also have, like, a weirdly, like, high investment in her being in a relationship with him, because basically her parents are, like, punk rockers, and the boy's a punk rocker, and Chloe Moretz is not. So they basically just really, really, really are, like, super...
See, that was the one part of the movie that I did like, though.
Guy to be more like us. It's a little creepy. But there's, like, one part where he shows up at our house, and he's like, I'm going to climb your balcony. And she's like, no. And he's like, I'm already doing it. And I was like, consent, guys. Like, she said...
that's just, like, a problem of delivery and editing.
But that keeps happening, because then later he
breaks into a different intonation. Yeah.
Well, it happens in a lot of YA books. It's like that in Twilight. It's like that in The Fault in Our Stars.
Well,
like,
yeah, and I understand.
It's very common. I'm not saying it's good. I'm saying it's sadly common.
No, and I understand it to a degree. I remember as a teenage girl feeling really intimidated about, like, the whole boy thing. And the idea of a boy taking onus of a relationship starting, I understand the fantasy appeal of that. But watching it play out in a movie like this was kind of gross because I thought, like, she had so little agency. She finally has agency when they decide to hook up. Which was hilarious because the where they decide to have sex is just
and
she has to say, like, I've never done this before. Like,
and then she
figured that out.
And I couldn't stop laughing. She's like, let's imagine it like you're my cello. And I'm like, nope, this is dumb. I can't. Also, the way that they keep reminding you that she's different from him because she likes cellos, it's like a cello is the background on her phone. She's wearing a cello bracelet. Like, it's just too much.
I feel really bad for people who are younger than us and are going to grow up thinking that this is what, like, a love life is like.
You know what? It's not. We grew up with shitty representations of young romance too, and I think we turned out okay. So I mean,
see, but our shitty representations of romance were like, you know, like 10 Things I Hate About You, and She's All That. Things that, like, played around and had fun with the idea. This takes itself so freaking seriously.
And Chloe Moretz, and I'm sorry, I know I'm, like, hating on all these pretty girl actresses today. She's not good in this. It's
she's
like she. I want her to have range, but I've seen this now, and I've seen Carrie. If she's not playing like a tough girl who's somewhat supernatural in some respects,
well, that's what I think that maybe she needs to be doing. I think she needs to be playing bigger characters and not real people.
I think that she's better at playing, like, kind of, like, strong, forceful, like, hard characters. And Mia is, like, you know what, honestly, I have to give her credit for, like, trying to, like, stretch her range, because this is a very, very different role than what we're used to seeing from her, and I admire that she's willing to take that risk, but it's not a risk that really pays off here. Like, she's so unconvincing.
Oh, she's so... There's one part where she falls on her knees and yells, oh, God, I just want it to be over. And the three of us started laughing because so did we.
Before we went into this movie, I turned to Lonnie, or while we were sitting there waiting for it to start, and I'm like, shit, I should have brought tissue, shouldn't I? And she's like, why? And then later in the movie, I wished I had tissues because I was laughing so freaking hard that my eyes were just, like, so freaking watery and dripping.
Honestly, this is a movie that, like, okay, so within the first 5 minutes, there's a lot of voiceover narration from Chloe Moretz in this. Anyway, so within the first 5 minutes, there's, like, the voice.
Not showing.
Yeah, there's a lot of voiceover narration, and she's like, it's like that old saying goes. And from that, I was just like, oh, God, we're, like, 5 minutes in, and we're already into those cliches. Like, I was like... I immediately wanted to be like, oh my God, I want to leave the theater right now because I don't think I can with this movie.
Eject button.
But I knew we were going to talk about it for this. I was like, okay, I'll stick around. Like, maybe it'll get better. It did not fucking get better.
You stood up and just walked past us and were like, I'm out. That would have been
I wanted to be, honestly, that I was like, you know, it's not fair to the movie. Like, you can't judge a movie by the first 5 minutes. But it was one of the, sometimes there are movies that you know right away, like, no matter how, you know. And I tried really hard to, like, well, give it a bit of doubt, but I knew. And, like, the thing is, like, this movie feels so generic. Like, even the parents, they're like, they're always like talking about how
see,
they like
that's
love the, punk rock.
That's like the
really
one thing that I would say is the opposite. That's the only part of this movie I liked was that her family was different, and I think that all the actors playing the family members had chemistry, and that they brought it out of Chloe Moretz too, because that was the one time that Chloe Moretz would be able to like let loose and feel like a person rather than a robot.
There are occasional flashes of this movie where you, I think I said this to you guys when we were leaving, like, there are occasional flashes where you could see glimmers of the perfectly mediocre as opposed to fucking awful movie this could have been.
Yeah.
There are, like, occasional moments where, like, there are, like, a few cute moments with their parents that I liked and stuff, but I felt like the whole movie as a whole is so generic. I mean, you were talking about how, like, the movie keeps being like, oh, she likes a cello, that's why her cell phone background is a cello, and she has a cello on her bracelet, get it? Get it? She likes a cello. And I felt like they were doing the same thing with their parents and, like, with the guy. Like, every single character to me, like, all the characterization felt that clumsy to me. Like,
I agree. I think this is a movie made for teen girls, and whoever made it thinks teen girls are idiots.
Yes. Yes. I mean, like, the thing that bumps me out is, like, we've seen, like, movies that are, you know, along similar lines, like, young, first love kind of stuff, done better. Like, The Fault in Our Stars is way better.
Well, that had much
spectacular,
better performances, too. I feel like The Fault in Our Stars never would have worked for that.
Spectacular
Now is
way better. Like, that's the thing. This movie doesn't have, like, a life to it. It just feels really dull. And the fact that it's mostly told through flashback is a real problem, because it's basically her, like, mostly flashing back to what had happened to her before, and it just it deflates the tension.
How about
then,
that flashback where
she's
having sex with him, and then all of a sudden it cuts to her laying in a hospital bed?
Yeah.
The thing about the flashbacks that I find really distracting is that then you see her in the hospital bed, then you go for, like, 20 minutes to her, like, being happy, and then when it cut back, I was like, oh, right, this is supposed to be a sad movie, because, like, I was, like, too busy watching
Lonnie
her.
Turned to me, like, a half hour through when we had first cut back to the hospital, and she's like, I forgot that happened. And then later on, Lonnie also turned to me, and she's like, is she going to die already?
Yeah, it's just, it's not the best way to tell the story. I mean, maybe it works in a book, but in a movie it just feels really redundant to keep going back to the hospital. And then at one point, the boyfriend says, I know this has been a really tough day. And I was like, oh, God, this whole movie takes place in 24 hours.
Yeah, like, oh, like, as they say when they take her to the hospital, oh, the first 24 hours are crucial, because that's what's
going to determine. But the relationship part was a year and a half.
Yeah, well, the story takes place over, like, from her childhood, because they flash back a lot, but the actual plot from, like, when we pick up with her on the day where her parents are in the accident to the end of the movie is 24 hours, and I was astounded by that, because it makes her a way more terrible character, because, like, there's a scene where they bring in her brother on a stretcher, and she runs to be with him, and he consents her there. They establish that. And she's like, I'm going to stay by you, but then somebody says something about her body, and she runs back to it. And then when I found out it was just a day, I was like, you legit stayed 2 minutes, and then your brother died. Like, fuck you.
So, spoiler, much of this movie is Chloe Moretz running up and down the hospital hallways
barefoot?
In bare feet.
Because her shoes came off in the accident.
But she had a coat on in the accident, too. And she would
like her. Her shoes came off in the accident, but she didn't get dirty and her hair didn't get messed up at all.
Okay, I want to say, first of all, even if her shoes came off, she should be wearing fucking socks, because who wears boots without socks? Second of all, it's a snowy day, and she has bare legs. She's not even wearing, like, stockings or tights, okay? She's
in Portland. She's
wearing, like, the most
dressing.
Flimsy, like, and that's the kind of attention to detail that this movie has, okay? That is not Chloe Moretz's
fault. That was, like,
that is
a grumpy cat face. Like, I feel like if I put that next to Grumpy Cat, you guys would look alike.
If I could get a pull quote that is just me being upset about a movie,
that's what the new pull quote should be. We should all just have to go out in, like, a photo booth and make faces after.
Yeah.
I would totally do that.
That's a really good campaign. I like that idea.
You know, that's a funny rating system. I think the next, all right, I'm going to brainstorm, but, like, I want to make this happen.
So, in conclusion, Perry, should people watch this movie?
Hell no. Seriously, you know how much I hated The Giver? If you were choosing and you were going to see a movie no matter what between this and The Giver, go see The Giver.
Okay, here is what I would tell people to do this weekend. You know, you can watch Sin City, you can watch If I Stay. If Love is Strange isn't playing in your area, stay the fuck home. Watch something on VOD. There's a lot of, like, great stuff on TV right now. Just don't. I'm so sorry. Just catch up on all the summer movies that you already missed. Don't.
Yeah.
Or just go stare at the wall for an hour and a half.
On CinemaBlend, we did a piece on 5 undersung summer movies you should watch. Watch any of those instead of this. And actually, The Giver's on there because somebody in our staff really liked The Giver. I didn't see it, so I can't comment.
Can you tell me who that is so I can go and like abuse him on Twitter?
You have to look. I forget. I think it was Mac. But I my picks for that were Obvious Child, which is still in theaters, and we loved Obvious Child. So go find Obvious Child. Or if you are just in the mood to watch something at home, Belle. Belle. It's period piece. It's funny. It's moving. It's sensational.
Look, honestly, you're better off turning on Netflix and watching Zoolander for the 18th time, okay?
Or The Simpsons Marathon.
No.
All right. Well, in that case, we went 1 for 3 this week. That's all the time we have to talk about movies today, but you can catch us next week, and you can find us all over the place. On YouTube, we are on iTunes, so go listen and watch over there, and also rate and comment because we love to hear what you guys think. You can also find us on our website, popcornprosecco.com. We are on Twitter, @popcornprosecco, and then all three of us are all over the web as well. Christy, you want to take it first?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter, @KristyPuchko, KristyPuchko, and I write all over the place, but you can keep up with my highlights at decadentcriminals.com.
Angie?
You can find me on Twitter, @AJHAN, and I write for slashfilm.com.
And I'm @PNemiroff on Twitter, and you can catch my writing on collider.com. So thank you guys so much for watching this week, and we'll see you next time. Say something.